you know, or just drink on and on. Because then I went to, as soon as I heard it, I went and talked to Quinn about it. She's fine with that.
Did she put both of them in? Or?
She put both of them in.
I call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this March 8th.
3:10.
2017. Excuse me. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2882. Madam Minister, what do we have? I didn't mean to confuse you.
You did, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
I appreciate it. 2882.
No, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Is that right?
Well, we had two on the front page, but
that's not the one I wanted to open. I opened the one on the death.
No.
No. The under life one.
Oh, that's the second one. 2393.
Sorry. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2393. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2393 specifies a case manager's duties in the event that a case manager receives notice that a person for whom the case manager provides services will have license-stating procedures withheld or withdrawn. We do have one person who has signed up, Mr. Chair.
All right. Will you call that person, please?
It's Mr. Bob Junedeff.
Mr. Junedeff, would you join? Thank you. I'll see if I can stop coughing so we can hear you.
Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2393. And I'd like to provide you with some background as to where this bill comes from.
Thank you.
In our statutes, as you know, we have an advanced directive law that allows people to designate the types of decisions that they would like to have made should they become incapacitated and need to have medical decisions made for them. And some of those decisions have to do with end-of-life decisions. The part of the chapter that has that law also has a provision as to decisions that can be made about end-of-life decision-making when a person does not have an advance directive or someone who's designated to speak for them at that point in their lives. And what it does is it sets forth a list of people that can be looked to make a decision, starting with guardian and close family members. And if none of those individuals can be located, then it allows the physician who's presiding over the case. to make that decision. The existing law says that if an individual, the incapacitated individual, that person has a case manager, a Department of Human Services case manager, that case manager should be notified that a decision is being made about that person. But that's all it says. It just says that there's to be notification. It does not give any authorization or direction as to what that case manager should do in that circumstance. Since I had involvement at that time when this was put into statute, I know that the intent was that case manager would be empowered to share information that the case manager had about that individual's wishes or desires. Not to give the case manager any authority to make a decision or any role other than one of sharing information. And so what this bill intends to do is to make that clear, that should a case manager be notified that this very profound and important decision is being made, that if they have information that's relevant to that individual's desires or wishes, that they share that with whomever it is who's empowered to make the decision. That's the entire intent of the bill, And our feeling is that by making that clear, it'll be clear to the case manager that they are authorized to share relevant information, and again, not to have any authority in terms of the decision-making process, but just to share information.
Is there any question? That seems simple enough. Any questions?
Rep. Kennemore.
Rep. Kennemore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who has the authority to make the decision for this person then?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Kennemore, right now in statute, again, there is a process by which a list of people are looked to. And that starts out with a guardian, if there's a legal guardian that's been appointed. Then, to the best of my memory, it goes. The next person is a spouse, and then we're taught. Then we move into children, and actually a close friend, and then ultimately, and if none of those individuals can be located, then the physician is empowered to make the decision. And that decision is about potentially withdrawing life-sustaining supports. Disability Rights might help. Disability Rights Oregon receives anywhere from 1 to 4, I would say, in a complaints a year, usually from individuals who are providers for folks with intellectual or developmental disabilities who have lifelong incapacities, who are nearing the end of life and are in medical treatment, and there's a concern on their part that their decisions being made are not fully informed. Sometimes, for example, a physician who is put in the position of making a decision really doesn't know very much about the individual or their disability. And so the desire was to just have some way to make sure that information could be provided in those circumstances.
But this doesn't in any way change who has the ability to make that decision.
That is correct. The authority remains exactly the way it is right now. And it does not take any authority away from those people.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick.
Tell me.
So I think some of this has to do with a court case that took place in Southern Oregon recently, but having with regards to a patient, somebody that doesn't have family members or representative to help make these decisions, if they were able to process food without a feeding tube, but didn't have the ability to get the spoon to their mouth, would this then allow that deciding committee whether or not we should lift the spoon to their mouth or not?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, the laws that we're talking about here have to do with potentially removing tube feeding, not with spoon feeding, if you will. I know the case that you're talking about, and the courts have ruled about that particular circumstance. This bill would not change anything having to do with that circumstance and would not apply to a decision about offering or not offering a spoonful of food, because that this particular statute doesn't apply to that situation.
So your follow-up. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So you're testifying before us today that this only applies to tube feeding.
No,
would only be applied in circumstances
of... It doesn't apply to anything. It doesn't change anything about that. All this bill does is talk about a case manager giving information to whoever's making the decision.
Excuse me, I couldn't hear that. Could you repeat what you said?
I said this bill doesn't change any of those circumstances about tube feeding or spoon feeding or or anything else. Is that right?
That is correct, Representative Green.
It just is, allows case managers to provide information if nobody else is there to do it.
But that...
Comment?
Yeah, no,
But that information would help drive the decision whether the life-sustaining supports were removed or not from that person, correct?
What information?
The information that you're talking about that's being provided to the case manager would help determine. That's why they're that's why they're providing that information, to help provide guidance on when to end life-sustaining supports. No? Am I totally missing the boat here?
The circumstances of the bill say if nobody else can provide any information and there is a case manager assigned to that patient, that case manager is authorized to provide information. That's basically all it does, to whoever's making the decision. It doesn't change who's making the decision. It doesn't change the consequences of that decision. It just talks about providing information.
How do you determine if there's no one else available?
And Chair Green, like I might add, it doesn't change the type of decision. So the exact type of decision that exists right now in this law, that this law allows, would be exactly the same. What it does do is it allows the decision maker to receive more information when they make their decision. The very same decision that the law allows to be made right now.
And that more information that they receive would guide them on what that decision to end life-sustaining support, correct?
And Representative Greenlick, Representative Hayden, it would, not to get too precise, but the word guide indicates, if the question is, could it more information influence the decision?
Be taken into consideration.
Could influence the decision, and in fact, the supposition behind the bill is that more information is better than less information.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. How is the decision made as to when there isn't representation, or how do you determine? Is that there's not someone there at the time to make the representation for the patient, so the case manager steps in? Is it that there's no one appointed to have representation? How do you determine when that's necessary?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, the case under this bill, the case manager has no authority to make any decisions. No decisions. All the case manager has the authority to do is provide information to another person who has been designated as the decision maker.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
Thank you. I don't think that's not what I was trying to get at. Sorry, I may not have asked that question exactly correctly. What I'm trying to get at is, when does the case manager have the ability to provide the information instead of, say, a family member or someone who's there representing the patient? When does the case manager step in to do that versus someone else for the family member or for that person?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, the law right now says that if they decision of this type is going to be made and the person has a DHS case manager, that the case manager is to be notified that the decision is going to be made. So that's the existing law.
But there is a criteria about who's making that decision.
Yes.
Starting from a designated agent on down through a family member. This comes at the end of all that list.
Right. And so if you looked, for example, if there's a person in a hospital who the physician considered to be near the end of life and there's a question about whether to remove or continue with life-sustaining supports, now the physician would have, in order to get informed consent to be able to do that, if the person is incapacitated and unable to give informed consent, the physician would need to look to a substitute decision maker, someone else who can step in and make the decision on behalf of the individual. And what the statute does is it gives a process for determining who that person should be. And so that person may and there's an order of priority for the physician to look to see if one of those folks is available to step in and give substituted decision, make a substituted decision. In order to provide an additional level of safety for a person with a significant disability, the law also requires notification to the case manager, if there's a case manager. So we're trying to include someone else who can at least provide information to the person who has been designated to make the decision under our existing structure.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other?
I know this is a delicate area, so I want to acknowledge that, but we're just trying to get better decisions made.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I think we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2393. We'll have a work session at some later time on it.
Rep Lively is here if you want to open the work session.
Let's do that. We are going to open a work session on House Bill 2402. Madam Minister, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2402 had a public hearing on very early in the session, February 3rd to be exact. If you'll recall, it was brought to us by Representative Lively. It establishes a program allowing a homeless individual to obtain a free certified copy of their birth certificate. Pardon me. The program will be housed within the Center for Health Statistics, creates the Free Birth Certificate for Homeless Persons Fund within the State Treasury, specifies January 1, 2018 as the operative date, but it is effective the 91st day following adjournment sine die. There's a minimal revenue impact, but a fiscal impact statement, Mr. Chair. There is a dash one amendment, and all that amendment does is align the state definition of homeless individual with the federal definition of homeless individual.
I was hoping to move this bill today, but we have to figure out what's happening with the fiscal that showed up. I'd asked Representative Lively to join us at the dais today for the purpose of this bill, and I've asked OHA to come and explain to us what that fiscal is about, and to see if there are changes to the bill we could make that would eliminate the fiscal. Because I hate to have this simple bill get trapped in these means unless it's absolutely necessary. So, thank you for joining us. Would you introduce yourself?
I'm Jennifer Woodward. I'm the State Registrar for the Center for Health Statistics from the Public Health Division and the Oregon Health Authority. And thank you for the opportunity to provide clarification on the fiscal. The fiscal impact that you have as part of the documents you have indicate that there's a fiscal between, for the 17-19 biennium of between $44,000 and about $94,000. So let me explain what this means. First of all, the $44,000 range is, and it's a one-time cost. That amount is a one-time cost. This is a new program for the Center for Health Statistics, so it is one-time cost to bring in staff to a 0.25 FTE for 6 months to prepare all the forms, work with the community, making sure that we have the forms and everything that we need to implement the program. The actual amount for the temporary staff is $39,000, and the $44,000, the additional, is usually the SNS costs that are added in to bring in new staff. The $94,000 is what they took is the $44,000 and added the $50,000 to that, because the way the bill is indicated is that there would be a fund for a free birth certificates for homeless persons fund established. But if there was no fund and we were providing the free birth certificates, we would not be getting the fee, the $25 fee. Now, the $50,000 is based on an estimate of issuing 1,000 certificates per year or 2,000 certificates biannually. And that's what estimate was done based on what we currently do where there is a fee. So we would likely see a much larger number if they were free. So the idea is if there was no money in the fund and we were requested to issue free birth certificates, that's where the additional $50,000 comes into this fiscal impact. So that's where the $94,000 come in. And then as you can see, for the 2019-21 biennium, it does say just $50,000 because the $44,000 would be the one-time cost.
I'm not sure that I understand why the loss of fee would produce. I mean, if it doesn't cost you any more to deliver free birth certificates, the fact that you don't get $25 or whatever that amount is, times some number. Does it dramatically affect your workload or something? What difference does it make if you end up not being able to get any money?
I'm sorry. Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, we're a fees-based agency, and so there is a fee in rule for doing a search for the birth certificates. And the fee for the certificates, a $25 fee, it's not just for birth certificates, it's all certified copies of vital records. And that's not only for the actual certificate itself, it's for all of the work and all of the infrastructure that's based on making sure that those birth certificates are kept confidential, that they're registered. So the way the fiscal is done, it's assuming that we would lose that $25 fee.
But my understanding is, in an agency, you have a certain amount of revenue and you have a certain amount of expenses. And your revenue and expenses are in balance now, okay. I assume. Does providing free birth certificates to some limited number of people increase your expenses?
There is an expense because there's the work. So if you're adding on an extra service, so it's an extra amount of work that we're doing to produce that service. We are providing a service and an item. So when we have people, an additional 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 certificates, there is work that's dedicated to produce those certificates. There's paper, there's the processing of, there's the maintaining of the system for those certificates and the staff time to do that. So that's where the $25 is for that item.
And you're expecting 2,000 birth certificates a biennium or a year? Is that
the 1,000 certificates was based on what we currently issue, where the homeless service providers pay for those certificates. We would imagine if free birth certificates were issued that there would probably be a much larger amount requested. Again, we don't know
why
for
is
sure.
That? I mean, they're now requested by homeless
agencies will pay for them. Most birth certificates that are issued to individuals who are homeless are actually ordered by family members who can pay for them. And we don't have those numbers because we don't ask what the status is of the person who's ordering the certificate. The only way we know this is because we've had homeless service providers pay for those certificates. But the individual themselves is ordering the certificate.
You're not assuming new certificates. You're assuming the loss of revenue from otherwise that you would have gotten for this population?
Yes. That's the $1,000 is based on that.
Well, that's interesting. That's the right.
You're getting a couple of hands.
Yes. Yeah.
And, well, we have Rep Hack and Rep Lively down there.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair.
You're up.
And you might be able to answer this. I understood it to be that the homeless agencies and those folks were going to continue to pay as they would have before. And we were just going to give an opportunity to kind of help those folks along and maybe be able to get a few more people some birth certificates that weren't able to. My understanding was we weren't going to completely cut that off, but this was just another great opportunity to be able to help some more people. But that's what I understood to be in the first hearing, that we weren't, that funding wasn't going to be completely cut off, but we were just going to say those agencies continue to pay what they had been paying to help homeless people get them, and then this was going to kind of supplement that to say let's help others get it if we can do that.
Representative Lively.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the intent when I started this process was working with some of the local organizations that did not have enough funds themselves to buy the certificates. And the goal was simply to provide more funds, not to supplant funds people are already doing. It does not mean that in some cases, as those agencies become short of funds, they wouldn't use some of these. But the goal was simply to continue the program that's already out there, but use some of these funds to pay those. The intent wasn't to have them do them for free. The intent is only to have a pot of money that those agencies could call upon when they're trying to get birth certificates for the homeless people that they could use for pay for those. And it wouldn't change anything, my understanding, would change nothing for the organization that's processing. They'd be processing them just like they do now.
This wasn't a new program in that context.
No. That was never my intent.
And you see it as a new program. Why?
Representative Greenlake and Representative Hack and Lively. So the way the bill is written, it does establish a new program. But the way the bill is written is it says that it establishes a free birth certificate for homeless persons fund. And that fund then would be used to do is exactly as Representative Lively said, is to replace the fees for the birth certificate. It's not clear in the bill if that there would be monies dedicated to the fund. So if there's monies dedicated to the fund, the $50,000 in this fiscal would be gone.
But all I'm talking about the 44 first. If all the bill does is produce a fund over here, why does that create a new program for you?
So the $44,000 is to bring in additional staff, a staff person, one-time costs, because what we are doing is we are being asked to in the way the bill is written, it is asking us to then determine who is homeless. And so a person would come in and say that they're homeless. And so we have no, and because what we want to do is we want to make sure we're giving birth certificates, free birth certificates to those people who are, have been identified as homeless under the Dash 1 Amendment, which is defining homelessness.
Well, what Representative Lively said is it's not producing a new program for you, it's producing a source of funds for those agencies to buy it as they are buying it now.
The way the bill is written, it says it will establish a new program. So we would be...
That's how we need to change that, is that right? So it doesn't say establishing a new program?
And then just clarifying exactly what our role would be, if we are expected to develop and work with the different agencies, if we are asked to do a lot of new forms and things, that's where the staffing would be.
Those agencies are buying them now. So you're already dealing with those agencies with homeless people?
Correct. And I think the concern would be how are we supposed to, in the Center for Health Statistics, a person comes in, they're ordering their birth certificate, and they say they're homeless. And under the definition that's in the Dash 1, my staff would be going through that definition and determining, are you homeless, are you homeless, are you homeless, and having to take the time to do that.
Do you do that now for homeless people?
No, because they come
so
in.
Why do you need to do it if there's a fund to pay you to buy some more certificates?
Because they're coming in as any individual ordering their birth certificate
and
paying for it. So there's no screening on whether or not they're homeless. The reason why we know they're homeless is because the homeless shelters are paying for their certificates. That's the only way. We don't ask them, are you homeless?
Well, if you can work with Representative Lively to get an amendment that would make clear to you, we're establishing this pot of money over here, which you would draw down, so you don't have either the $44,000 or the $50,000. Because apparently
that's
all this bill is intended to do is to create a fund to buy some more birth certificates from you.
I'd be happy to help with that.
Okay. Kelly Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems like it would be obvious then that the amendment would clarify that it would be the nonprofit organizations that are doing the vetting.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what's happening now. Anyway, they're acting on their behalf. It's just all we need is money for the fund so that if you need any money for the fund to in order to not to cover the fees, but no new program, no new FTE on the part of OHA.
How's the money going to get into that fund?
How's it going to get in the fund? We're going to allocate the funds.
So out of the budget here, so we need
general fund.
So we need to be able to estimate how many different birth certificates will be purchased.
Well, Mr. Chair, so originally when I talked to the local groups and talked about it and talked to OHA, what we agreed was, so let's say we wanted to do 1,000. When we looked at what was already happening and when I talked to certain organizations of how many more homeless they had that they thought would do it, we thought the best approach, so that's $25,000. So originally, that's all we were going to ask for was $25,000 over the biennium, do that and have those organizations that work with homeless track to make sure we were getting. Because what we want is those people to use that so they can get an identification card so they can get other services.
But
so
we need a fiscal that will simply buy a bunch of birth certificates.
Right. That's all the intent ever has been.
Now. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, we need to make that clear. It's not creating a new program for you then.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Kenema?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, in Section 3, it says there's established in the state treasurer as separate and distinct from the general fund free certificates for homeless. So it's established in the treasury's office, a fund. But I don't see where that puts it anyplace else. And it's to pay for them. I mean, that seems pretty straightforward English to me.
Did you have a chance to review that? Okay.
Representative Green, Representative Kenema, yes. And I guess this situation is there actually a fund that could do that?
It would create one.
And then the process we could establish, which would be relatively easy, we have other funds, we would have the certificates, count them, and have a cost center, and we could just charge it directly to that fund. So the homeless service providers could be providing the attestation of whether or not the person is homeless, and we could just actually go charge directly into that fund. If they came in with a form saying, I've attest that this is a person who's homeless who needs a birth certificate, we say, fine, we keep the count, we do the count, and we just hit that fund.
Give you the $25.
Mm-hmm.
So that would take away anything except the fiscal for putting money into the fund, and you would only be responsible for producing as many birth certificates as the fund could buy.
And establish, making sure that we communicate on how do we know that the person is homeless. And we could be working with the homeless service providers to do an attestation. They walk in with the form saying, yes, please issue this person a birth certificate, and then we would
take them. Do you have a form now for?
It's a regular birth certificate order form that is all the population uses.
So why would you need any other form but that?
I think what we would want to do is have something following Representative Kenny Geyer's suggestion of having the homeless service provider say, yes, indeed, this person is homeless and attest to that.
But homeless service providers buy birth certificates now.
No, they.
I want you to create a new form that would you then be able to charge $44,000 for creating a form.
Right now, what the homeless service providers do is they actually provide a check. So the homeless individual walks in with a check from.
And if they would continue to do that, you wouldn't need any form. They would provide a check, and they would walk in with that check.
We could make a revision of our form without the $44,000.
You have to make a revision of the form. It's the same form that happens now.
I think what we'd like to do is have the availability for the homeless service providers to have the form, and we could say, are you just attesting that this person is homeless? So our team is not having to ask all the person the questions related to the definition of homelessness.
But you don't know when they buy a homeless person.
Because they're coming in and handing us money and saying, I'd like to order my birth certificate like the rest of the population.
All right, and if they continue to do that, would be paid out of a different fund, then why do you need another form?
I guess that we could work out the details on how we would want the money to go, if it would come directly from us.
I don't see any detail.
I think the difference is that what the homeless service providers are doing is they're actually giving a check and it's coming out of their budgets. What we could do with this program is the homeless service providers would not have to actually write a check or pay any money. The homeless service providers could just attest to that fact that the person is homeless, and we would just go directly to the fund and take the money from there, so the homeless service providers aren't having to spend the money. So
I don't think there's anything in this bill that says that.
it's not clear exactly how the fund is actually administered. So, but we could, there are different options for that. If the money wants to go to the homeless service providers for them to write a check and hand us the money, we could do it that way, or we could do it directly to go directly to the fund. It's just a way the fund could be administered. There are different options for that.
We need to get our Ledge Council to do this to make sure we have an amendment that makes sure you don't have to do anything different. You just have to take the money when it comes to you.
If that's what you'd like to do, that we could work on how the homeless service providers then actually get reimbursed directly from that fund versus the Center for Health Statistics.
Yep. Let's get a guy.
No, Rep. Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Or did you...
Yeah, just real quick, you've mentioned a $25 fee. I see on the website here, if you order regular mail, it's $25, and you get it in 3 to 5 weeks. If you order rush mail, it's $25, you get it in 3 to 5 weeks. But if you walk in, it's $28.25. If you call on the phone, it's $44.95. And if you go to the internet, it's $43. Typically, as we try and drive services to the internet, it reduces cost. I do see that you tie in, if you order from the internet, that you get it rush mail. But can these nonprofits order from the internet and get it regular mail and get it at $25? Because nonprofits are probably using mostly the internet for this, right?
Representative Chair Greenlick and Representative Hayden. The difference is what we have found with the homeless population is they are actually coming into the office or via mail. And it's most likely because of the extra charges for the internet uses. There's a fee for processing the credit cards. We allow 24/7 access via the phone and on the internet. So there is an additional fee for processing the credit cards, an expedite fee. So what we found with the homeless population, they are either ordering through mail with the help of a homeless service provider, or they're coming into the office.
$25 to $43 is a sharp credit cards fee, percentage-wise.
And that's a fee that is put on by the vendor to help us with processing those credit cards.
I think it's time to close this work session. I'm going to close the work session on, what are we on, 2402. Ask Representative Lively and your staff and the Legislative Council to word things in a way that makes clear the only fiscal will be putting money into a fund of the treasurer. Does that work for you?
Yes, that does. Thank you for your patience. I thought this was a pretty simple concept. I was just trying to help the homeless people, but we'll work on it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in. Okay, where are we going to go?
We all can relate to that.
Municipalities,
money. Yeah, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2392. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2392 modifies the requirements for health benefit plans to cover expenses relating to hearing loss treatments. And we have some folks.
Why don't you call the first panel?
Reagan Gray, Chad Ludwig, and Claire Leek. Or Leek.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Reagan Gray, and I am typically in front of your committee representing a client, but today I am a parent of a child with bilateral profound hearing loss. And my story is when Anya was 1 year old, we noticed that she wasn't developing speech at the rate that her older sibling had. And so we went in to get her hearing tested and found out that she had this hearing loss. And then my next thing was I needed to get her hearing aids. And that's when I ran into the problem with the current insurance mandate for covering hearing aids for kids. It obviously isn't adequate because of, and I'll tell you about the issues that I had. So I contacted my insurance provider and said, who can I go see where you guys will cover it at the highest rate that, you know, you'll cover it, that's in an in-network provider. They were able to give me one person. I contacted that person to set up an appointment, and they had a two-year waiting list. So I contacted the insurance company again and said, okay, you've got to have somebody else that I can go to and be able to purchase these hearing aids where you guys will cover it. And they gave me five phone numbers, and I called those phone numbers, and it was diabetes equipment, wheelchairs, everything but hearing aids. Went back to the insurance company again, got five more numbers, and then it devolved even further. I even got a phone number for a auto body repair shop. So at this point, I was getting pretty close to open enrollment, and so I switched insurance plans, made sure that the plan covered the audiology, pediatric audiology group at OHSU, and was able to get into an appointment in about 3 to 6 months, and finally got her hearing aids. It took me a year. Wow. A year to get her hearing aids. Disgusting. She was 2.5 by the time she had her own hearing aids. The other issue that I had was... she needs FM, and all children need FM receivers in their hearing aids to go to school. And because teachers wear these things that are essentially microphones that'll go directly into the hearing aid. Without that, the rustling of papers, kids making noises, creates too much of a block, and they aren't getting they're not getting the sound information that they need. I also need one at home with her, and I wear it around. It helps her really hear the enunciation and hear like the T's, you know, in a word, or the S at the end of a word. And also, it's a safety issue at the park. She can't hear me if she's running into the street, but she can hear me if I'm wearing this. This was not covered by insurance. I paid $3,000 out of pocket for this. So after my experience, I reached out to the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Advisory Committee to identify folks that have experienced similar things, and it was a group of parents, educators, and providers, and from that we came up with the language that you see before you. So what this bill does is it updates the current mandate that we have in law, and what we're asking to add into that is the initial paying for the initial and ongoing hearing evaluations for children. And I really want to stress the ongoing hearing evaluations. Their hearing changes over time, and the hearing aids need to be tweaked to deal with that. And so we really need to be covering those appointments. Fitting and verification processes when they dispense the hearing aids. The supplies required for the use of the hearing aids, like the ear molds, and these ear molds need to be remolded often because children grow, and as soon as there's a little bit of space where air can get in, it's just this feedback, that high-pitched feedback noise that the kids get, and essentially the hearing aid doesn't work for them at that point. Also covering equipment like this, the FM systems and other assistive listening devices. Cochlear implants are not currently in the statute, and I've heard from parents that had a lot of difficulty getting their insurance companies to cover that. And cochlear implants are amazing in allowing children that weren't able to benefit from hearing aids to now access sound.
I remember putting that in the statute.
We put a hearing aid mandate into the statute, I believe cochlear it was in 2009, but cochlear is not listed in there, in the statute, the current statute. So we ended up adding it in the language. The other thing was requiring insurance companies to contract with an adequate number of pediatric audiologists so that the situation that I had doesn't happen again. I wanted to thank the committee for introducing this bill as a committee bill and giving us the opportunity to speak on it. I've heard the story from other parents. I've heard similar stories from providers. I kind of take the opportunity now every time I have an appointment with a new provider and ask them, what kind of problems have you had with billing, or what kind of issues are you having with, are you seeing your families having with access and costs? And I think that we've identified a lot of issues in this piece of legislation, and I really hope that we can do this session. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Good to see some of you here today. My name is Chad Ludwig. I'm president of Oregon Association of the Deaf, and I'm here to support this bill. Some of you may remember 2015 legislative session where we were looking at SB 449A to establish Oregon Hard of Hearing Service, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, but that bill didn't survive. And instead, Ways and Means awarded a $200,000 grant to do a community needs assessment. A Western Oregon University did that report, and that report was posted last December. Part of the community needs assessment, the university met with a lot of families and parents and healthcare professionals. And the stories were overwhelming about the critical needs of access, needs for audiologists and hearing aids. That there was a need because they weren't involved without that. There was issues of isolation, of separation, of depression. And so we wanted to take time to recognize those needs and ask you to really support this bill. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Claire Leek. I'm here in support of House Bill 2392, which, as you know, is to update the current hearing aid mandate. I am a speech and language pathologist who works exclusively with children with hearing loss to help them develop their listening and spoken language skills. I cannot reiterate enough the importance of early diagnosis, early access to sound, and quality intervention. When these components are in place, children with hearing loss are able to overcome the challenges of having a hearing loss. They may attend their neighborhood school alongside hearing peers, require fewer special education services, and become productive members of our community. Denials, long waits for evaluations, and high out-of-pocket expenses for necessary equipment should not prevent our children with hearing loss from receiving or from achieving their full potential. Families and employers who pay for private insurance should be able to depend on their insurance to cover the services and technologies that are necessary to help grow babies' brains. Our families know time is precious, and we want insurance companies to acknowledge that too. So Reagan covered a few components of the bill, but I want to reiterate some of the components. So the bill would update legislation to cover all evaluations which are necessary for audiologists to track children's hearing losses over time, as they may fluctuate or change and new equipment might be needed. It would require the coverage for the fitting and verification procedure, which is the procedure an audiologist does to make sure that the hearing aid or cochlear implant is providing the benefit that the child needs. Finally, it would cover additional supplies like batteries or ear molds that are needed to make sure a hearing aid works. A hearing aid does not function without those pieces. And finally, it would cover repairs for hearing aids. A child on average hears 12,000 words a day. So when a child's equipment is not working, they're missing out on the critical language that they need to build their baby's brains. When they're missing a year, because of long waits, they're missing out on thousands and thousands and thousands of words. I also just want to speak briefly on the assistive listening devices that are covered in this bill, so FM and DM systems.
Briefly, please.
Yeah. So those, again, help children hear in noise and at a distance, which are necessary in a lot of environments that children participate in, like church, sporting events, for safety, and to hear friends at a birthday party. And then finally, it would cover cochlear implants when medically necessary. As far as I know, there's only one state in the United States that covers both hearing aids and cochlear implants for children, the state of Wisconsin. That's my birth state, and I would be honored if my current home state joined the ranks. And really showed families that we care about children with hearing loss, and that when a child is born with hearing loss in this state, and there's about 100 a year, our families know and can rest assured that their children are covered.
Thank you. Are there any questions to this panel? Could you call the next panel, please?
Okay. Orla Maloon, Ann Smith, Amanda Haas,
Please remember to identify yourself.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity. My name is Arla Mellum, and I am a pediatric slash educational audiologist working at Columbia Regional Program for deaf and hard of hearing students in Portland, Oregon. And our staff provides services to over 500 children across four counties who are aged birth to 21 years who've been diagnosed with hearing loss. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2392, which would change the mandate requiring private insurance providers to include the necessary services and technology to the deaf and hard of hearing students who require these components so that they can maximally access their education and achieve their true learning potential. These services would include paying for hearing evaluations, providing appropriate hearing aids or cochlear implants and their upgrades, and subsidizing other equipment such as FM systems or assistive listening devices, which Reagan spoke about, accessories and replacement parts. The problem has been that research has shown that if children are not identified early and are not amplified appropriately and consistently, they may fall further and further behind their hearing peers in areas of auditory development, speech and language acquisition, social skills, literacy, and academics. And there are some statistics out there that show that children who do not receive treatment for hearing loss cost the education system an additional $420,000 and are faced with overall lifetime costs of $1 million in special education, lost wages, and health complications. And in my experience, and I've been doing this a long time, private insurance companies have not always paid for what we need them to pay for. They haven't always paid for ongoing hearing evaluations, which is absolutely critical as the first step in determining appropriate treatments for children. And now we're seeing children, you know, soon after birth due to the newborn hearing screening. So that is awesome. But in the past, it hasn't been paid for always. Insurance companies have not always paid for appropriate hearing devices. And I've seen families be so stressed and troubled and confused about where they're going to get the money for these hearing aids. And we've had to scramble around trying to find alternative funding sources. And this is, we need to have this mandated, whether it's for one ear or both ears. Families have not routinely been able to upgrade their children's devices to keep up with changes to their child's hearing loss. As Reagan was saying, kids' hearing losses do change. Changes in their needs to listen and changes in technology. And as you, I'm sure, know, hearing aids, cochlear implants, they're miniature computers. And we have to keep up with changes in technology to provide kids what they need. And we have to fit them properly. We have to verify them, which is the job of the audiologist. And we need to make frequent changes to programming, especially for young children who are just learning language. We need to cover non-warranty repairs of the equipment, ear molds, and batteries, which has been talked about. And in the past, and we've talked about FM systems, which is as if you could take the child's ear off their head and put it next to the speaker. We all know, you know, if you have normal hearing or hearing loss, noise is very challenging. And it's especially a challenge and a struggle for deaf and hard of hearing students, whether they're babies or they're seniors in high school and beyond.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Oh, okay. Please. So anyway, we need to have FM systems funded. We need to have cochlear implants funded so these children who don't benefit from hearing aids can have access to sound, and they're never off the air. Their equipment's always working. So I think, you know, why this is necessary. We want to front load these services, so we'll increase the chances that these children will be able to succeed at a level commensurate with their hearing peers, or even at a level above that, avoiding any negative impact on society. Thank you very much.
Yes, please.
You go ahead. Hello, my name is Amanda Vass. Thank you for letting me speak to you today.
I promised him that he could say a little something, but it won't make any sense to you, okay? Did you still want to say something? No. Okay. We're working on verbal language. We can sign, but we're working on verbal language. I'm the parent of a deaf child. Ollie here has cochlear implants. He got implanted at 1 year old and a little before 2 years old when he got the second one. I also work for a nonprofit organization. We'll go home in a minute. I also work for a nonprofit organization that helps families that have children with hearing loss. And so my hands are all over the community, and Eugene is where I'm from. And what I find is that it costs... Oh, he's changed his mind. Yeah? No, okay. What I find is that it costs a lot of money to raise a child with hearing loss, like a lot of money. We have to buy an extra warranty for each cochlear implant. It costs $800 a year, just hoping that that one is the one that breaks and not the backups, because we can't afford to, you know, insure the backups that he has as well. The thing is, too, is that Ollie was born with a part of his brain missing. So this is what makes me really passionate about what I do, is that children that have hearing loss oftentimes are born with a fully functioning brain. And all they need is language. It's the only thing they need in order to succeed. And so Ollie's just learned how to walk in the last year, just very basic life skills. And everything comes so hard for him. But you have all these kids, but sorry, I digress. But I still see his main thing of hearing loss being like the main disability that we need to work on, because it's how he has access to learning and to language and to the world. You know, I'd rather he be bedridden with language than out in the world walking with zero language. So for children that I see in our community, parents are not able to afford all the things that insurance has, all these nooks and crannies of, well, we can pay for this, but we can't pay for this. And it just so happens it's going to cost you hundreds of or thousands of dollars. So if we could help parents afford raising a child with hearing loss, we would really make huge strides in the community to have the children with hearing loss be able to read at a kindergarten level when they go to kindergarten and keep up with their peers, with their hearing peers. So I think that there could be a lot of good just for society as a whole if we had children with hearing loss able to keep up with their hearing peers. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Okay. Chair Greenlich and members of the House Committee on Healthcare, my name is Ann Smythe, and I'm speaking to you today as a parent of a child with hearing loss and as a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing. In both of these roles, I've seen firsthand the negative effects of an insurance system that does not adequately address the needs of children with hearing loss. We know that when children with hearing loss are identified at birth, properly fitted with hearing devices by 3 months, and in early intervention programs by 6 months, that they have every possibility of developing age-appropriate speech and language and academic skills. Many will never even need special education services in school. Knowing what is possible for babies born with hearing loss makes it all the more tragic when their families are not able to access the proper equipment and services for their child. Reagan testified earlier about her insurance only offering one in-network audiologist with a 2-year wait list who wasn't even dealing with pediatrics. When families get a diagnosis of deafness, they're told time is of the essence and that they need to get amplification and start services immediately in order to access the short window of time a child's brain has to make sense of sound and learn language. Navigating the insurance process during the midst of this terrible diagnosis for a family with a newborn is daunting, to say the least. My own daughter was denied a second implant based on the fact that the device was experimental in spite of a massive amount of research to the contrary. It took a year and help from a lawyer to get the denial reversed. In the meantime, she lost a year of valuable time when her brain was not hearing with two ears. Brain research tells us that kids with hearing loss do not have time to wait. This is a brain emergency. As a result of the great delay in getting her second implant, my daughter will never hear as well with the ear with that ear as she does with the other ear. If I had had someone to help me understand the process and explain the devices she needed with the insurance company, such as a case manager component that is in this bill, that would have been an immense help. So,
the insurance company cover the cochlear implant?
What? I'm sorry.
Did the insurance company cover the cochlear implant for you?
Several years ago, so they weren't covering those standardly. Now more insurance does cover them, but I'm not sure if all of them do. So FMs are a tool that have become a necessity for deaf children. They not only help the child access learning in the classroom, but they also help the child hear during sports, hear when their parent tells them not to run in the street, hear in noisy play areas. FMs are part of the deaf child's best chance at reaching his or her full potential, and these should be covered by insurance. Fortunately, all these problems are solvable. Insurance can help families with a deaf child access the equipment and professionals they need to reach their full potential. What's more, it's a problem we should all want to solve, as it will lead to better outcomes for deaf children and less cost in special ed services down the road. This is the outcome we want for all our children. Please help make it happen.
Thank you very much. Can you call the next panel, please?
I will. The last two are Elise Brown and Jessica Adamson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Health Care Committee. Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans. AHIP is the National Trade Association of Health Plans across the country, and it's with difficulty that I sit here and have to be before you to share some concerns about House Bill 2392. But let me start with something personal. I'm a legal guardian for my adult sister, who's severely mentally ill, and she's had hearing aids her entire life. And as her legal guardian, I'm on the hook for a lot of healthcare out-of-pocket expenses. And oftentimes it's for hearing aids and upgrades and the like. So I hear the frustration from the witnesses before me. So I wanted to start with that. But I'm also a representative of the insurance industry, and it's my duty to also remind you, as you're considering a bill's mandates like this, that there's a cost that we all bear, and I wanted to remind you of that. House Bill 2392 expands on the current mandate. We've talked a little bit about what the mandate that we have now does and doesn't do, but this does expand the current mandate by creating new requirements for coverage. It also will set a minimum benefit in there, a minimum benefit amount in statute, which we think is problematic. So next to me, I have one of my AHIP members from Providence. I'll let her share a little bit more about some of the implementation difficulties for this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services. And I'm not here to take a position on this bill today. The policy choice of whether expanding this mandate is up to you, and we defer to the wisdom of this body. I would not, however, be doing my job if I didn't raise what Elise just did, which is there is a cost associated with this. And again, we just want to make sure that as you make this decision that you're aware that there are rate impacts to increasing and to mandating a certain level of service. But again, the policy choice rests with you, and we are not taking a position as to whether or not that ought to occur. One point I do want to raise, though, and we would like to work with the advocates if this bill moves forward, specifically about the network requirements. As we understand the language today, it would be a certain amount per thousand on a health benefit plan. And so if you're looking at, for example, the individual market, and we represent about half of the individual market in Oregon, depending on the ebb and flow of how many folks that is, we're concerned about making sure that we can contract with enough folks to meet that requirement, and knowing that we try and set networks before we go out to the individual market. If there is a shift in that, being able to make sure that we can get enough specialists within that network. So setting that number is going to be important that we get that right. It's a conversation.
Fire alarm?
Didn't realize what I was saying.
Scared the shit out of me.
Me too.
I'm going.
I don't want to go out.
Oh, you'll be fine.
9.
Please come back to order. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2882. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members.
Let me make the comment. If we end up running out of time on some of those work sessions, we'll move them over to a Friday. We've got a light schedule on Friday.
No.
I was also planning on starting at 8:30 on Friday rather than 8.
Just as a reminder, I won't be here Friday.
I know, I remember.
I'm reminding, too, I won't be
here. You're out there, too. I have it. Madam Administrator, what have we got, please?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2882 comes to us at the request of Representative Nose, Kenny Geyer, and Representative Bueller, primary chief sponsors of the bill, requires a coordinated care organization's governing body to include a representative from at least one dental care organization that serves the members of that CCO, declares an emergency effective on passage. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 individuals signed up, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll call the first panel.
I missed the emergency clause, sorry.
Parsimonious, if you will.
Mike Shirtcliffe, Matt Sinat, and Joe Bell will be the first.
And who's left after that?
Jim Bunn and Jeremiah Rigsby.
Okay, guys. Say what you have to say, but not anymore.
Gotta love that.
What did you say?
Chair Gingrich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Mike Shirtcliffe. I am a dentist and the founder and president of, and CEO of Advantage Dental. I appreciate the opportunity to speak for you today. I'm gonna. You have a written testimony before me, before you that I sent in. It's a little different because of Bill. It's interesting to me that. This whole issue has the politics around this issue. As some of you may know or may not know, and some of you might not even recognize me because I saw you last, I've lost 90 pounds. Mm-hmm. So, and it wasn't because of illness. It was either a choice of heavy illness or change my lifestyle. So I elected the latter, not the former.
Congratulations.
So enough people have asked. I actually wrote down how I did it. So if you want a copy, I'll send it to you.
Let's go.
In fact, I've run into a lot of you in the hallway. You don't even know who I am, so it's been fun to do. So thanks to be here, and I appreciate it. Some of you may not know, I had the opportunity to sit on the group of people that developed the legislation around transformation. Representative Greenlick knows because he was here, and he was a big part of that. And every day we
came on Wednesday night meetings.
Yeah, and every time we came in, there would be a different chair of the committee because of the split house at that time. So it was quite interesting and to watch the politics. But I... When he passed the legislation, it was to get a group of people around the table that would govern the government, give the health care back to the communities and have the communities have some say. And you know, it was a work in progress, and as you folks are working on, is trying to make it better all the time. But one of the things we did was we got to sit around the table. And what we're trying to do is integrate oral health, physical health, and behavioral health, as well as getting the community involved and whoever was financially responsible, give them more votes. You know, there's a lot of arguments around that, which is a subject for another day. But one of the things that happened to me is I actually am contracted with all 16 CCOs. And so I can tell you a lot about the 16 CCOs because I get to deal with all of them. I'm the only group in the state that deals with all 16. And one of the things that we put in the language that who got to sit there, and one of the major components of the healthcare delivery system. We all knew that the hospitals were a major component of the healthcare, but one of the things we didn't specify was that oral health and the DCOs, who really are the major component of the healthcare delivery system, who worries about Medicaid dental, we didn't call them out. But of Senator Bates and Representative Freeman and Representative Kotek actually read it into the record, and everybody knew at that time that a DCO, a dental care organization, was a major component of the healthcare delivery system. But it's as you can see from the map, I've given you only six CCOs have a DCO on their board. And there's a lot of politics around dentistry, because only 80% of the dentists, actually 80% of the dentists, do not participate in Medicaid dental, and those of us that do, about 20% of us, we organized ourselves in dental care organizations to create the access to care. Now, I come today as a dentist, because I am a dentist. I'm the most senior dentist in the building today, with the exception of Representative Hayden's father.
He's here.
Who's upstairs, and who I've known for a really long time and have great admiration for, and in fact was a big part of helping us get to where we are today. And I come with a dentist because it's beyond me. It's beyond me, because I've spent 22 years of my life working on Medicaid folks to try to create access to care. And I have never seen so many politics over trying to get around the table to have a real discussion around what we ought to be doing in integration and what we're doing. And I wish that all of my compadres in dentistry would all participate in Medicaid dentistry, but they don't. And those of us that do, we seem to struggle. We seem to really struggle with being able to get heard at the table and have some voice around it, because, you know, we actually do know something about taking care of Medicaid folks, and that's our purpose and our goal. And I don't see, I mean, this is the third session that I've tried to get to a CCO. If we're going to have CCOs that integrate oral health, physical health, and behavioral health, then the folks that do oral health, the DCOs, ought to be sitting at the table being part of that discussion, because what I can tell you, those CCOs that don't have a DCO representative are not doing as well when it comes to integration, because I work with all 16 of them. So this is a simple bill that, and I very frankly don't care who decides which DCO in that region gets to sit on the table. I don't care if the CCO decides or the DCOs decide or the large. It would make sense that the largest DCO ought to be sitting at the table, but I don't care. But I do care, and I think it's behooving. I think, as the last statement of my testimony says, is my opinion, it is to the CCO's detriment and the detriment to the citizens of Oregon that we don't have the folks that have that deal with this at the table. And doesn't seem to be able, we're able to get them there, and so we've come in with a bill that hopefully we can get it to where it's required. Now, one thing I will say, there's a reason.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
I know, I'm done.
Got 5 bills.
Yeah, I know. We've got about, I'm out in 30 seconds. There's a reason why we have state laws. And one of the reasons why we have state laws is sometimes the local communities they have dysfunction. There's a reason why we have federal laws, because sometimes the states get dysfunctional. And on this, and I know that we DCOs are subcontracted with CCOs, but I think the state and you, the legislatures, need to know that without having the DCO representative at the table, you're not getting the bang for your buck you're paying for. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, please.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Sennett. I'm Director of Government Affairs and Contracts with Willamette Dental Group. Willamette Dental Group appreciates the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2882. We also believe we are uniquely qualified, similar to Advantage, and as Mike alluded, to testify on this particular topic. We contract with 11 of the 16 CCOs. We serve 85,000 OHP members, and we have two Willamette Dental representatives on CCO boards, one layperson and one clinician. WDG does not support House Bill 2882 as drafted in introductory language. However, we do believe that assuring oral health is incorporated within all CCO's structural hierarchy is critically important, and I think Mike touched on some of those issues. The two I would focus on are, one, it's foundational. As Mike alluded, oral health was unequivocally clarified as a major component of the coordinated care model. Secondly, transformational. Oral health is upstream. Oral health is primary care, and oral health is prevention. Yet our experience as a partner to 11 CCOs has taught us that prescriptive approaches tend to impede, not enable transformation frequent enough. As drafted, this has the prescriptive model where the threshold would be set based off market share. And as Mike alluded, and we very much appreciate, that's not the most critical element. It's the representation. And for that, we are grateful. Because for us, not only would the language as drafted force an existing Willamette Dental representative off a CCO board, candidly, our interest is not even about the governance. It's about what's our intent. If the intent we're trying to achieve is transformation, inclusive of oral health, via the coordinated care model, as introduced, we did not see House Bill 2882 as the proper vehicle to get us to that place, and for the following reasons. CCO structural hierarchy versus governance. In our experience, and Mike has more experience across the state than us, but the experience we have taught us that the structure that underlies the board, and it looks a little different in every community. Those are the committees, the work groups, all those things that work up, network and finance and quality. Those are the underpinnings that make the CCO engines turn. And frankly, we think there's a lot of opportunity there to better connect the oral health piece. We also believe that the governance playbook, as we've sort of dubbed it informally, is actually a critical element. There's another bill in this session related to one of those components. That's the Community Health Improvement Plan, and the other side of that being the Transformation Plan. I sit in one of our board positions. I sit on the Trillium Board as the layperson. And I believe that a lot of what we do at the board level, whether indirectly or directly, is attributable to the work that germinates out of either the CHIP plan or the Transformation Plan work. The boards make critical decisions, but it's a lot of those underpinning functions and structures that drive a lot of what transformation really ends up being. That doesn't single-handedly exist at a board of directors level. Therefore, to a degree, we think that really getting into a focused on prescriptive modeling for governance may be treating more of a symptom than it actually treats the root cause. Lastly, we believe that prescribing in this manner may impede. As it relates to oral health, this would effectively sort of base it purely and strictly off market share. And I know Mike alluded, and we appreciate, as I said moments ago, that's not the most important element. And for that, we're grateful. But I think when you look at what the intent of the CCO's governance structure is, it's supposed to be community-based.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Sure. So ultimately, we believe oral health should be meaningfully incorporated into the CCO structural hierarchy. However, CCO flexibility must be reasonably afforded to ensure we maintain a community-based representation. Having said that, we are not suggesting that governance is the linchpin, let alone the only mission-critical element of transformation. In other words, it's not a silver bullet. Rather, we believe the hierarchical structure underlying the board, the CHIP and the transformation plans included, are not just a silver bullet. They may well be a golden gun. With that, I close my
Thank you.
Comments.
I'm going to suspend this hearing for a few moments and do a little work, if you don't mind, and we'll call the last panel. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2726 for the purpose of moving a bill to Ways and Means. Madam Administrator, will you comment on this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2726 had a public hearing on February 20th. Directs the Oregon Health Authority to convene a work group to evaluate and implement an outreach and marketing strategy for healthcare for all Oregon children's program, permits all children residing in Oregon that meet the financial eligibility requirements to be enrolled into the program. Mr. Chair, we have a no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal statement, and it does have a prior reference to Ways and Means.
Can I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2726 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and for the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2726 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on this motion? Okay. Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Bueller.
No.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenema.
No.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
No.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
No.
Chair Greenleaf.
Aye. The motion carries. 2726 is on the way to Ways and Means. I'd like to close the work session on 2726 and open the work session on 2319 for the same purpose. This one needs to go to Ways and Means because they said we need to do some rebudgeting. It's not that it has a fiscal. Would you tell us what we have?
Correct, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2319 had a public hearing on February 15th that creates the Mental Health Regulatory Agency. It's directing the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists and the State Board of Psychologist Examiners, even though their name has changed now. Right?
It hasn't changed quite yet.
The governor has assigned it. Okay, to jointly appoint the director to serve as at the direction of both boards. Mr. Chair, this has a no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal impact that requires additional analysis. There are no amendments to the bill.
Can I have a motion on this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2319 to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and that the bill also be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Notes moves House Bill 2319 to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on this bill? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kamigaya.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Noakes.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2319 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session on 2319. Open a work session on 2304. Sandy, you might talk about this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2304. We had a public hearing on the 1st of February, our very first day. This is at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. This is adding the peer support specialist, which would include family support and youth support specialist, to the definition of the peer wellness specialist. It defines family and youth support specialist, directs the health authority to adopt the qualification criteria. Mr. Chair, there's a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the original bill.
We have a motion on House Bill 2304, please.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2304 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Notes moves House Bill 2304 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just want to ask a question, Mr. Chair. So we are not considering any of the amendments at this time.
We're not considering any amendments.
Okay. I would just like to express support for the peer support services. I recognize that we want this bill to go through, and I want peer support specialists to be included in the traditional health workers commission.
If it gets amended and gets a fiscal, then it's going to get hung up.
Okay, so I hope we continue to try to find ways to support peer support specialists before we get out of the building.
Keep working on it.
And I hope to work with.
Could you please call the roll?
Representative Kamigaya.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Noakes.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenland.
Aye. The motion carries. Would somebody like to carry this?
Kenmer. Yeah.
Representative Kenmer. Representative
Kenmer. Yeah.
Representative Kenny Geyer will carry it. Close the work session on House Bill 2304. And go back to the suspended public hearing on, where were we? 2882. Show you're next, and we have, who else do we have? We have two more. Why don't we invite them up?
Okay.
Go ahead and finish this.
Joe?
Okay, go ahead.
Jim Bunn and Jeremiah Rigsby.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I guess it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry?
I wondered if Willamette Dental had an amendment to the bill.
Capital, we're going to hear from them right now.
Capital?
There is an amendment.
Willamette.
I'm sorry. That's what I thought. A couple of amendments. Is that right?
One is Jeremiah's and one is...
One's Health Cares and one's...
Let's hear who we're going to hear.
Coalition.
Joe, I think you were next.
Yeah. I'll be succinct, Mr. Chair. Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record today, I'm Joe Bell, and I'm testifying on behalf of Capital Dental Care. We are also a dental care organization in Oregon, and we contract with 14 of 16 DCOs. While Capital Dental supports the concept behind having a dental care organization on the board, we are not supportive of the language that you currently see in the bill. We really do not like the fact that it is so prescriptive on how the CCO is selected or that it is based on the size of the membership. We really would prefer to see something that is more collaborative amongst the DCOs that are contracted with any of the CCOs to come up with representative for the CCO board. That being said, we are more than willing to work with Advantage and other interested parties on amendments, and in fact have been working with Advantage on an amendment, and I understand that there are two, and I have not been able to contact my client because she left us to go to Hawaii, so as soon as she's back, I know, isn't that, that's just
this
not fair.
Great,
huh? Anyhow, she shall be back tomorrow, and I will be talking to her about the amendments and continue working with Advantage and others on potential amendments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn representing Advantage Dental. In 1989, I had the privilege of debating on the Senate floor what would become the Oregon Health Plan. It has evolved greatly since then, and sometimes it's a little hard to remember all of the steps in the evolution. But we have audio to go back and review, and I'm going to read a couple of comments later. In 2011, House Bill 3650, and a year later, Senate Bill 1580 made huge changes to Oregon's healthcare system. Change brings fear, and fear brings the need for assurances. DCOs feared being lost in the stampede toward transformation. We asked for and were given assurances that we would be included in governance of the CCOs. That has not happened with most CCOs. Speaker Kotek, Representative Freeman, and Dr. Bates were carriers of Senate Bill 1580 in their respective chambers. All three called out dental in an effort to assure us that we would have a voice on governance of CCOs. On the House floor on February 23, 2012, Representative Freeman, as carrier, stated, Senate Bill 15 is an important bill that provides the framework to coordinate the major components of the Oregon Health Care Plan. These include, but are not limited to, physical, mental, behavioral, and health and oral health care. This is from Olis, and I cited the specific on the tape. On the Senate floor on February 14, 2012, Dr. Bates, as the carrier, stated about Senate Bill 1580. It provides structure to the governance requirements, ensures participation of all major providers, including dental MCOs within the governance structure. I want to read that, just part of that again, including dental MCOs within the governance structure. Dental MCO, dental DCO, they're interchangeable. The legislative intent was clear. DCOs were to be included in the governance of CCOs. Now, 5 years later, only a few CCOs have acted to truly integrate oral health with physical and behavioral health. House Bill 2882 will restore the intent of 1580 by putting one DCO representative on each CCO board. And I understand there won't be a work session today, but just to mention, as other DCOs expressed their concerns, we listened to those, and with Representative Hayden's help, came up with Draft 1 amendments that stripped out the 50% designation to say that they're automatically the representative, and stripped out the 10% floor so that neither of those matter. And simply say in the dash one that the majority of the DCOs within the CCO pick the DCO that will have the representative. It's very simple, very straightforward, and I think, although they'll have to confirm it themselves, that that addressed the bulk of Willamette and Capital's concerns. The dash two, however, are a disaster, and the dash two were proposed by CARE Oregon. One of the issues
deals with saying that it can be a dentist or a DCO. That's like saying it can be a doctor or a hospital. They're very different perspectives, and we believe that a DCO, which has for 20 years provided oral health, needs to be at least one of those board members on that CCO. If they've got 20 members or whatever their number is, let one be a dental care organization. But the other provision is even more troublesome, and it strips out on line 25 and 26 the current requirements that persons that share in the financial risk of the organization who must constitute a majority of the body. Now, I feel a little bit like I'm in a rowboat and I just got the Titanic dropped on top of me, and I'm not taking a position for or against the language, just that our rowboat doesn't need this. We're dealing with dental care organizations. The relating clause to this bill is dental care organizations, and I believe this amendment violates the requirements on relating clause, where lines 25 and 26 bring in a new subject that is not relating to dental care organizations. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you.
Well, walking through memory lane, I also remember in those debates, I helped write those bills, the dental care organization wanted to be kept out until 2017.
And 2017 is here.
Here. It's time now, but the fact of what's happened in the last several years may not be quite as relevant. Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I work for Care Oregon. As you guys know, we own Columbia Pacific CCO up in the northwest portion of the state, and we own Jackson Care Connect down in southern Oregon. We have over 100,000 people in HealthShare, and we're closely aligned and have a managed services agreement with Yamhill Community Care Organization in Yamhill County. One thing I don't mention often is that we also own a DCO, Care Oregon Dental. Provides oral health to about 40,000 Medicaid patients in the Washington County, in the Tri-County area, Washington County, Multnomah County, and Clackamas County. We oppose the bill, HB 2882, as written. We also think it's pretty prescriptive. But I want to take a moment and commend Representative Hayden and others who traveled to talk to each CCO and figure out what the barriers are to integration. I'm sure Representative Hayden found out quickly that the barriers to integration, especially for oral health, are different in each CCO. And I think it's pretty hard to fix those barriers with one bill. I don't think that's a reason to not try. I think we're at a point in time now where you can't just say integration and expect it to happen. I think you have to actually start walking that talk a bit and figure out how to push integration forward. We have a Dash 2 amendment that we feel does that, and I understand that people feel that it does that. I want to talk at first about what the Dash 2 amendment does. The Dash 2 amendment does something that has not been in statute quite yet. Right now in statute, no CCO governing body has to have anybody they contract with on the board. We do have to have someone who is a licensed physician or nurse practitioner specializing in physical health. We have to have someone specializing in mental health. Maybe it's time we start having someone that specializes in oral health or a representative from a dental contracting organization on the board, and maybe that's not enough. I think we'd be willing to talk about what an amendment should look like to make integration happen. I think you have DCOs saying that it doesn't mean having a DCO representative on a board. It's much bigger than that. I think from our experience with our DCO, it's not as easy as just having a DCO rep on the board. But I think maybe in some areas that's what you need. How do we craft an amendment that doesn't throw out the good things that have happened in CCOs that are not bad actors, but it still makes it easier to integrate in places where it's been a problem? I also want to speak to part of the Dash 2 amendment that I did not realize was in the amendment. I think you referenced line 25 and 26. I'm going to have to take a look at that, but that wasn't our intention to be a huge disaster here. So looking forward to working with the DCOs. I appreciate the DCOs' testimony. We also agree that it's time to do integration seriously. We want to keep pushing the ball forward on oral health integration. We understand that we probably have not done enough yet. We also understand there's 16 different ways to integrate and infinite amount of reasons why it hasn't happened. So looking forward, I know it's not a work session now, but looking forward to working on amendments.
Representative Hayden, you have some comments on this?
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for everybody that came and testified on this, as was testified to. My staff and I took the time in October to invite ourselves to every one of the CCOs and to see them locally at their place of business. So we traveled all over the state. Interestingly enough, Eastern Oregon Coordinating Care Organization is in high-rise in Portland. So we didn't.
Where else would it be?
So that was just one interesting caveat. But in that, I asked two questions to all of the CCOs. It was the same two questions. I told them, I'm going to ask you all the same two questions. One was, how do we integrate mental health? And there was various answers to that, which is, I think, the last frontier that Oregon needs to tackle. And I think it actually lacks a little bit behind oral health currently. That's not the subject of this bill. The other question that I asked was, are you willing to have a dental care organization on your governance body? Flat out. Just laid it out there and said, are you willing to do this? The responses of the 16 CCOs that I met with, five of them have a CCO or a DCO representative currently as part of their governance body. One of them has a dental member representative, which isn't technically a DCO, and the rest, the other 10, don't. So in 2014, we added oral health to the CCOs with the request, please integrate. We're in 2017, and my point of going around to meeting all these folks is, how come you haven't integrated dental care organizations in your governance or in some fashion? If you're willing to put on a dental member, you've had 3 years to do that, yet 10 out of the six have not done that. There was only resistance from one CCO out of the 16 that said, no, we do not want that. There was one that questioned it. There was five that said, great, we already do it. Thanks for coming to see us, and we talked about mental health. And there were nine of them that said, sure, we don't care. We're not opposed to it. So that was the report that I got. And of the CCOs, the nine that didn't care, none of them are here. Of the CCOs that were opposed to it, you've heard the testimony, or the one CCO that was opposed, you've heard the testimony from that CCO today. And so I think it's time that, unfortunately, through legislation, we have to push this integration forward. I think it's time. We've had, yes, they wanted out, they were out. Now they're in. They've been in for 3 years. And if we're going to be serious about integration, unfortunately, I think we have to have a legislative solution for it.
Do you think you can smooth the words out a little bit for one last shot?
I think I can.
What do you mean?
So what I'm saying is that...
No, I just mean, if, can you work with them so we can get it in a way that you'll have...
So, no, I do want to say, on the Dash 1 amendments, the majority of the DCOs that have engaged are comfortable with that because it takes out the prescriptive language of 50%, 10%. It just says that it will be a DCO and the DCOs have to decide.
So give them a mechanism to decide.
So the DCOs will have to build their own mechanism to decide who is that representative rather than allowing the DCOs. For 3 years, we've had the CCOs choosing to decide that mechanism, and 10 have chosen not to. So rather than allowing them to continue to choose, we think the DCOs should choose who that one member is, and the Dash 1 amendment would allow that to happen.
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I want to compliment you on all the background work that you've done, and honored to co-sponsor this with you. I also hear the cry for, while you're giving us a very strong nudge legislatively, can you build in some flexibility? So as you have these conversations, I've been having a lot of conversations the last few days as well, I think it's really important that the preference be for a DCO with the eye toward integration. I think someone who's just an oral health care provider operating on their own and not a part of a DCO misses the point. So I do think that a DCO is preferred. But if you don't have any reps, some people say, well, what if there's not anyone willing to serve? You know, if you said a DCO or an oral health care provider involved in integration, I mean, it would have, I'm trying to leave an out there for if you need flexibility, but I want the clear preference to be where we want it to be. And then whether that representative is chosen by the other DCOs or CCOs, I think needs some more thought. I might lean toward the CCO choosing a person. We don't have anything else here in the governance structure in which a small body gets to choose the board member, so I have some questions about that. But I think overall you're on the right track, and that's why I was proud to sign on to this.
Thank you.
Mr. Ketterman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple of comments. One is in looking at the Dash 2 amendments, I think Mr. Bunn is correct. In my view, we probably need to have that looked at, but I think it violates the relating clause. Second thing that I guess is essential, my name's on the bill, is I think there's an issue regarding financial risk, and those are the people who should be on the board.
Last word?
Last word is I don't know if I'm required, but I want to state for the record that I am a dentist. I provide dental services, and that could be construed as a conflict of interest. If I need to address that, I'm happy to do that.
I think you're a member of a pretty large class.
Still would like to say
it. All right. Thank you very much. I hope we can, I assume we can work this thing out. Not too much more problems. I will close the public hearing. Which one?
2882.
2882. Close public hearing. We're adjourned 8:30 Friday rather than 8.
You said those of you that are coming.
I'm not here.
That are coming.
I'm not here.
You said those of you.